are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
I'm a man that likes a hot shower and a hot dinner, and I like to fly to hot countries for my holidays. So I'm not one of nature's obvious acolytes of advocates for the circus that descended on the great city of Glasgow over the last week or so. And there's more, much more, apparently, still to come. It's a bit like the Edinburgh Festival has relocated, the Fringe, I mean, relocated to Glasgow. The streets are full of, how shall I call it, performative political theatre. Dancers, people dressed as witches, rain dancers, anti-rain dancers, anti-sun dancers, all kinds of dancers and indeed comic singers. But I accept that not everyone feels that way. You've got the chance to vote on my first poll. On COP26, do you wish the climate activists A, success, B, tickets to Timbuktu, C, a good wash? Well, that's your opportunity on my Twitter feed, on my YouTube and on my Telegram to opine a provisional judgment on the first part, at least, of COP26. My old friend, Kevin McKenna, one of Scotland's most distinguished writers and commentators, he's probably a bit greener than me. We'll soon find out. Kevin McKenna, welcome to the Mother of All Talk Shows. Thanks for joining us, Kevin. Thank you very much. Last week. I won't bore you with the details, but I didn't get in time to interview you then.
It's great to see you taking the train, George. That's
that's at least a contribution, isn't it, Kevin?
Very, very environmentally friendly of you.
Well, yeah, that's my first question now. Why did this have to happen at all? Why was Glasgow Airport and Prestwick chock-a-block, and Edinburgh, chock-a-block with private jets, with billionaires like Jeff Bezos, burning the atmosphere to come in person to something that could have been done on Zoom? Is that a legitimate question?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate question. I've got a kind of horse in this race, so to speak, because my daughter, Siobhan, who's 29, was named a COP26 climate champion by the British government.
Good for her.
Unfortunately, they invited her to a reception hosted by hosted by Boris Johnson the other Friday, and she didn't really want to go. And I said to her, "Well, I think you should go, because she runs a small sustainable business, restoring and remaking discarded denim, all very environmental." And I said, "You know, you should go. You'll make good contacts. It's good networking." And she didn't. One, she said to me, she didn't like the idea of mixing with so many Tories in an enclosed space, controlled though it might be. And secondly, when she asked how much they were willing, the UK government was willing to help her with her costs, because it was going to be 150 odd quid in the train, the same again for a night or two in London, they said, "Well, we can advance you £50. And her response was, "Well, if they really wanted me there, they would have met the full cost, because after all, they can find as much money as possible for their rich donors, and they can make an auction out of PPE equipment during coronavirus." So she didn't go. However, I did interview her, and I put that almost exactly that same question to her. And she said that, "Look, we have conferences every day of the week, in every country, at every hour, for all sorts of reasons. And this is the sort of, this summit takes place once every 4 or 5 years. The last one was Paris, wasn't it? 2016. Yes. So 5 years ago. And that if we can get most of all the world's leaders in the same place and even, you know, just forcing them to come to some kind of agreement on things that are largely beneficial, even you know, even if you're cynical about what eventually makes it off the page, it shouldn't be too difficult. It shouldn't be too difficult, and it's not too onerous each 5 years. However, your point about airports and the air travel is well made, because not only were they flying in their private jets, but they were using them as effectively as a taxi service. So they were coming in their private jets, dropping them off at Glasgow, and then taking off again to park 30 odd miles away in Prestwick. So the, you know, there was these bemused Glaswegians, you know, waking up most mornings last week and to the sound of, you know, jets, little jets flying overhead west into Glasgow on a half hourly basis almost in the first 2 days.
I did see Joe Biden's beast, an 8 mile a gallon armored tank vehicle, in as part of his convoy of, I think, 75, some people said more, 75 American vehicles. He was staying in Edinburgh and traveling, like Nicola Sturgeon does every day, to Glasgow in a convoy. It was all a bit contradictory. That's my point, I think.
Yeah, yeah. What's the phrase they use? The optics. The optics didn't look very good, George. I'm not sure there were 75. I kind of lost count, maybe 25 or 30.
There's a magical picture, Kev, of the beast outside Greg's at Finiston that I used to represent. That's maybe he stopped and went in for a steak slice.
Yeah. That will become one of the defining images of the COP26.
Well, here's, if you like, a deeper point. I've been in politics a long time. You've been covering politics a long time. If a government tells you they're going to do something a year or 2 years come January, you'd be right to be skeptical about it for all kinds of reasons. One parliament cannot bind the next parliament. There's many a slip twixt cup and lip, and so on. But when somebody pledges to do something in 2050, or in the case of India, 2070, when we'll all be long dead, I can't really take that kind of thing seriously, Kevin.
Yeah, there's a lot of political leisure domain in this. The governments, as you know, in so-called democracies such as ours, they very rarely make any promises beyond the length of the term in which they are serving. They only really want to make commitments to stuff that they can claim the credit for. So you don't normally get governments pledging reductions in unemployment or percentage increases in education spending 15, 20 years hence, because they might not be around and somebody else will take the credit. And there's nothing that politicians like more than, or hate more than, other people taking the credit. This is almost, this is quite perverse. So we're being asked to take and trust that these pledges of deforestation, etc., it will happen, but they won't, because there were dozens of countries who had pledged all sorts of stuff at the Paris Agreement and haven't. And the reason why they haven't is because we have dozens, hundreds of the world's richest corporations who also turn up at these feasts like locusts. And they indulge in what we now call greenwash. And to them, environmentalism is simply another business sector with its own language. And they spend billions between them every year on lobbyists. to ensure that anything concrete that is contained in the document, which will be forthcoming at the end of next week, whether it's called the Glasgow Agreement, I don't know. But their task over the next few years will to ensure that those words stay on the page and never jump off the page into action. But in the meantime, an awful lot of people can eat out. A lot of politicians can be seen taking selfies with each other, looking statesmanlike, making these pledges, which you can't. You can't deny the pledges simply because they're so far in the future. Just as they can't guarantee that they will happen, nor can we say, well, they won't happen. And this is a magical little formula.
Yes.
These people.
It's a no win, no lose. You can take selfies and not look statesmanlike, of course. You could look like a photo bomber or a gate crasher. There was a lot of that about the performance of the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, didn't you think?
Well, I did. I was a little bit disobliging of Nicola in a column I wrote yesterday because, yeah, okay, she's been slightly upstaged simply because this is a UK government show in Glasgow, in her backyard. And Boris Johnson had said publicly a year or so ago that under no circumstances was he going to allow Nicola Sturgeon anywhere near it, because presumably he thought she would use it to grandstand over Scottish independence, which to be fair to her, she hasn't. So if you're Nicola Sturgeon, of course you want to be seen there, and not unreasonable, other people would like to see her there. She is quite well known across the world. The only problem for her and her SNP administration is that while this was happening, there has been a bitter, an increasingly bitter, several weeks long bin strike by refuse workers across the city who get paid between 17,000 and 20,000 a year, which is, as you and I know, is barely able to sustain a household. And these people were hailed as heroes by the political classes for 18 months because every day during the worst health crisis the country has known, they were literally putting their bodies in the line to provide an essential service for their fellow human beings. But the rhetoric that the SNP administration in Glasgow City Council has used to try and portray these trade unionists as aggressive and extreme has echoes of Thatcherism and the 1984-1985 miners' strike. And, you know, they have begun to use scab labour to remove some of the rubbish. They've said they've accused the trade unions of deliberately using COP26 as a means of bribing the city, which I thought, well, that's great, because there are very, very few occasions or opportunities for working people to leverage the influence that they have, mainly due to the anti-trade union laws that Mrs. Thatcher brought in and which the successive Labour governments have manifestly failed to unstitch. So you had this, you get this unfortunate thing happening where you've got Nicola Sturgeon having selfies with the rich and the powerful of the global elite, and literally yards from the front door of the Science Centre, there are very low-paid workers standing out in the rain looking for support and being jeered and being catcalled by SNP supporters who accuse them of doing Labour's bidding in a way by means or by trying to do down the independence movement, which is ridiculous. So it's not a good juxtaposition. And
will that have any long-term impact? Because, of course, the SNP, although when I was young they were rightly called tartan Tories, over the last decades have been at least affecting to be the new left. Will this lurch at the very first whiff of the grape shot of the General Municipal and Boilermakers Union, will this have any effect on, well, frankly, the sweetheart relationship which most Scottish trade unions now have with the SNP?
It may do. You know, another irony of this, and this standoff has been full of ironies, George. Another irony of this is that you have, prior to 2014 and the first Scottish independence referendum, and I sincerely hope there will be another one, but we can discuss that another time. Immediately prior to that, in the years leading up to that, the SNP worked furiously to get to grips with the trade union movement, to insinuate themselves into their good graces, to try and wean them off Labour. And to a certain extent, it worked. There were a lot of Scottish trade unionists who previously wouldn't have entertained the idea of independence, but having seen the nature, the extreme nature of the Conservative government stretching into the future with UK Labour singularly unable to lay a finger on them, they felt that independence might offer them an opportunity to build a fairer society along kind of deeply held socialist principles. So having done that, at the first, as you said, you know, the first time there's a bit of a standoff, yeah, okay, we know they're the party of government, and governments and trade unions shouldn't really be getting too cosy, but it's the rhetoric, the language that the Scottish government, and in particular their administration at Glasgow, the biggest and most important city in Scotland, you know, which has been deeply troubling, and I think has caused a lot of anger in wider trade union circles.
Kevin McKenna, thank you for joining us on the mother of all talk shows. Apologies for last week again. The podcast had another incredible week with a rise of 14% in total downloads. That's on top of last week's 10% increase, making us not only one of the fastest growing political programs on screens and on radio, but now in podcasts too. We're now one of the top political podcasts, not just in the UK, but also in Switzerland, Japan, Germany, Thailand, Taiwan, and believe it or not, the UAE. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts, and remember to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And why not leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts? If you're a Spotify user, please follow us and share with your friends so more people can enjoy most.